In one of the Burmese lineage, when we report about our practice to the teacher, there is a particular form to the report. I learned that the hard way. One time I was sitting, I think it was a 2-month retreat with Sayada Upandita, very respected teacher. And I had to report every day, just a few minutes every day, I had to report about my practice. Everybody had to. And I got kind of kicked out of the interview room a number of times. And in this way, I found out how I think I was supposed to report, what I was supposed to report about. And maybe also I could hear others, the person before me. You could always hear the person reporting before you, and then I would be heard by the person who was going to report after. Here we do it in group, in a different, slightly different way. And I remember at the end of the retreat, you know how when silence is broken, people start chatting over the meal. How was it for you? And then in the little group I was in, people were saying, oh my God, I was so happy. I got the document at the beginning of the retreat on how to report. And I was like, oh yeah, that document. I kept referring to that document. And I was listening. I was like, what document? I didn't get the memo. I didn't get the document. And so somebody was nice enough. They ran to their room, got the document for me. They gave me the document. I left and I went to read the document. And I was like, I can't believe this. This would have been so helpful. And yet I know all this now. I know this. Like, now it makes sense. But I know this from, but what I liked in that process, although it was hard, is I did not only learn to report, I learned to practice. That's why I remember this, otherwise I would probably have forgotten this. But through this way of reporting, I really learned to practice. And so so what I'm referring to is what is called the three questions. The three questions. It says when you go see the master, the revered teacher, there's three questions you want to answer. And what you'll report about is not generally your retreat in a general way. It'll be very, very specific. So you'll choose a moment of practice. It could be sitting, walking. It could be in the food line, it could be while eating, it could be even in your bedroom, resting, but a moment of practice, formal or informal, but a moment of practice. And then you'll say, what was happening? I was walking, I was standing, sitting, etc. I was in the middle of the dining hall. So what was happening? How was it known? How was it known? And what happened after? So these are the three questions. And what was happening is just the base, you know, the. So there's not much to it, in a way, you know? So you could be reporting a big bout or wave of anger, confusion. It could be an emotional state that you happen to, you know, to experience, you know, like somebody you know, you want to know what was happening? I'll tell you what was happening. I put my toast in a toaster. That's what was happening. And somebody came, pushed the button, put my toast on the side, and they put their toast in. This is what I was practicing with, you know. Okay, so what was happening? Somebody took my toast out and put theirs in. So this was my, you know, the core of my, the most dramatic moment of my 2 months retreat. When somebody dared push my toast out. So it's, in a way, it's not really important what was happening. It's something that was happening. And then the core question is the middle question. How was it known? How was it known? And here, it's wide open. And that's what we're practicing here, is the how. How are we meeting this? And for me, when I, you know, the first, so it was 2 months retreat, maybe the first 6 weeks, my focus, no, I don't think it was that long, but for a number of weeks, what I wanted to report about was the central question for me was, what was happening? Did you see the way I just did? Like, what was happening? I'll tell you, somebody, like, all the focus, but it was not on how it was known. How it was known seemed not so important in a way. It was what was happening. So in my understanding of life, this is the core question in terms of happiness. Is it happening my way? Is it not happening my way? And therefore, I'll be either miserable or good, you know? And the whole how is it known was kind of moving the cursor. Is that the way you did it? Moving the thing towards, actually, what is core is not so much what's happening. What is core here to your well-being is how is it met. And so here we're working a lot on the how. How is it met, you know? What was happening? He wasn't ringing the bell. That's what was happening, you know. I wanted the bell to ring, but he wasn't ringing the bell. You know, how was that met? And that's where there is potential here. How is it held? Is it held with curiosity? Oh, strong reaction, lack of control, want to grab the striker, you know. Can I crawl to the striker without nobody noticing? Or how is it with interest? Oh yeah, big irritation, big strong desire crossing the field, you know, being felt in the body. How is it known? Was it known with mindfulness? Were you totally identified with what was happening? Or were you judging? I shouldn't feel like this. It's fine. They put their toast. They don't know it was my toast, you know. I shouldn't feel like this. I should be so much more calm and zen about it. And then, you know. So how is it known? By judging oneself? By really believing? People have always been like this with me. They never care about me, you know. Kind of expanding on the subject, on the situation. Or noticing, wow, strong reaction. Anger, disappointment, confusion, shame, laughter, maybe a little humor in there, etc. So noticing, was it known with mindfulness or without mindfulness? Or when did the mindfulness kick in? So the third question, what happened eventually? Ah, he rang the bell. And then suddenly the whole tension in the body released. Or, you know, eventually I started to notice how I felt, not just obsessing about the person and that person, and I had seen that person, the way they closed the door, by the way, is exactly the way they treat toasters, you know. And at some point I just turned the attention, like, oh, how is it to be here? You know, what eventually happened? Or at some point I discovered it was their toast. The whole story wrong. You know, so something at some point happens, it changes us. Oh, I forgot about it because I was late ringing my bell, you know, I don't know if that, because of the toaster, I forgot I was the bell ringer. And then I started hating myself. So I went from hating the person at the toaster to hating myself. So that core question is what we're working with here. How are we meeting what is there? So it's not like we're trying to, maybe we're trying a little bit to have a series of pleasant experiences. You know, oh, I'm on retreat, you know, I'll do this lovely nap. Oh, beautiful outside, lovely walk. Lovely this, lovely that. Oh, I managed to almost have the love, despite Pascal's schedule and the whole Buddhist thing, I almost succeeded in having a great day. You know? I just reorganized a few things, and it was a series of pleasures. You know, it's not exactly what we're looking for here. You know, we're not looking to have a series of pleasant experiences. We're looking to see how we can meet what is happening. And in a way, I like the schedule for that because, well, in a way, I decided the schedule, but it's a little bit kind of a classic schedule in this lineage. But what I liked, what I like about the schedule is that it's a little bit like life. We don't get to choose exactly, you know, when we're going to age, when there's going to be disease, when people are going to say what they say, or leave, or appear at the wrong time, or, you know, like we, what's news, how it's, you know, who's going to be elected, what, you know, all these things, we don't. And so the schedule for me represents a bit this. It's not exactly what I would do during the day, maybe, you know. And because it's slightly defective in this way, it allows me to see how am I going to accompany myself through this. So the Buddha is talking about unconditional freedom, you know, despite the schedule, despite the toaster, despite the bell not ringing, despite having forgotten that I'm ringing the bell. Like, how can there be freedom, peace, well-being, connection, creativity? How can there be creativity, although it doesn't go according to plan, or my way, etc.? So I like these three questions. I find they're very informative for me for practice. What is happening, Pascal? How is it known? How could it be known? Could it be met? So this is about relationship. Meditative practice is highly relational. You could say it's only this. How we're relating to what's happening. How we're relating to what's happening outside, the bell, the toaster, etc. But also how we're relating to what's happening in this body. What's happening in this mind here. Maybe especially today with this this invitation that we maybe seized, it was the right time or not, forgot, remembered, about mind state. You know? So that here is like something like there's a suggestion in these instructions that maybe there's a different way to be in relationship with mind states by being curious about them, you know. With afflictive emotions, sometimes we are either totally identified, worrying, or we don't want to worry anymore. I'm tired of, you know. So we, and here we're saying like, oh, maybe there's another relationship. Maybe we can be aware that there's worry here, you know. And in that relationship, then maybe we'll be developing, cultivating compassion. The capacity to be with without being lost in, which is not easy, or without rejecting, hating, you know, but aware, being aware of. It's a very particular way to be in relationship with what is happening around and inside. And here we have the chance to explore this. And even the meandering, it could be easy to mistake this by going from one, looking for one pleasant experience after the other, you know, like, warmth of the sun, and then, a flower, and then, and it could be this, it could take that form, of course, here, there's so much beauty. So it could take that form, but also there's a study of mind state. What is awe? You know, not just, wow, it's amazing, but what is the experience of awe? So being aware of, oh, that's how awe is felt, and how awe kind of gets, chopped if something happens, something crosses the mind, you know, like, oh, you know, later today I think it's going to rain, you know, and this is all going to go, you know, or, oh, I have to go back to Toronto, you know. And like just a thought, and then to actually know that, oh, look at this, kind of arise and maybe stays, linger, or as reverberates in the body in some ways, or as a sense of healing to it, like to stay curious, not thinking about, but staying aware, being aware of, curious about. Beauty feels like this, the encounter with beauty, and then whoops, up, suddenly it's cold. That has changed, like the tonality of the experience of the has changed, you know. Or we go from appreciation to kind of wanting to own, you know. It's so beautiful, so beautiful. I'll come back here at the next walk. You know, suddenly I'm not in the moment. I'm just organizing to keep. Don't touch, you know. This is mine. You know? How can I keep this? What's the strategy, you know? Okay, when he rings the bell, I sneak out quickly first in a slow way. Nobody will know. I'll get what I need. You know, and to notice that, oh yeah, we went from one thing to another. Like it's a different relationship. There was a relationship of discovery, and now we've moved into a relationship of owning, keeping. This slight little movement in the mind that we can become aware of. And so that's part of what we're studying here, how we're holding things. Without judgment, that's mindfulness is curious, like, oh, voila, now there's grasping. It's different, like I'm clinging to this, you know, it's mine, you know. Or do people, you know, I'm walking slowly, I hope people see how slowly I walk. You know, do you see, like, how suddenly, like, I exist in a certain, or want to exist in a certain way, you know. And oh, well, I've just seen this. No judgment. Oh, I'm horrible. Look at this. I make this about me again, you know. No, that's what happens in minds, you know. Suddenly there's this thing where something is lost and something appears, you know, that is of a different quality. So we have the chance here to explore this, these movements of mind. And to discover for ourselves in a felt way, that's the depth of this, the profundity to me of this is that all these nuances we get to discover for ourselves in an empirical way, in a felt way, and we get to clarify at the level of experience to have a reference, an experiential reference of this. Oh, I know. When it goes from this to that, you know, from, you know, a contracted mind to, you know, to, why did they do this to me? To, it's not easy for us to be together, you know, there's challenges, you know. When the mind goes from contracted to decontracted, open, or opens up a little bit at least, or when it goes from open to kind of contracting around something. We have the chance here to see this happen in different ways. And this is informative, is almost a euphemism. It's that to me, that's where I would want to use the qualification of deep and profound, because it's felt. It's felt. There's a, and so it's not intellectual. You know, kindness is good, hatred is bad. It's we get to experience it when we go from one to the other, when we are touched, maybe like porously from the outside, something opens up and we experience it. But, here's a reference of a good way to be in relationship with stuff, something, a situation, something felt inside or outside. And so that's the study we're doing here. It's important that we go in these different mind states. You know, that we spin for 20 minutes in resentment or whatever else could be, you know, to experience it in some ways, like the how it does, what it does to the body, the heart, and then when it vanishes, there's a different feeling here on the other side of that. And so it's not like we come here, we get the lists, you know, the list of detrimental attitudes and the list of beneficial, wise attitudes. It's not like this. It's much deeper than this. We navigate the world of mind states, the ways we're in relationship with things, and we get to feel. It might feel very costly because it means that, you know, we're really going to feel things. But it's it has a way to, I'll use the verb convince us. That's my immediate translation of vipassana here, to really give us the information about how things can be held or met. Yeah. And the third question, what happened after? And this question sometimes would come from the teacher. You know, you do your report, and then often this question might would come if the teacher is generous enough to give it to you. What happened after? It's really interesting because it looks like nothing. You know, it looks like almost conversational. Hey, what happened after? But it's a very delicate pointing to that message that the messenger might be bringing to the queen, you know, helped by the guard. And so, what happened after? Just so it helps make conscious that it's changed, it moved through. That whatever was there, the obsession, the pain, that there was some fluctuation that helps us notice this. So you might want to play with this when you come to group tomorrow. If you want, you don't have to, but that could be a way. I mean, if it resonates with you, if it makes sense, you know. And that might be something that I'll have in mind as a, you know, teacher also. So what was happening? How was it met? And you know, like it could be like, there was at some point I was sitting, the breath, just knowing the breath, it lasted about 4 or 5 seconds. Then I started thinking about something that had happened at home or that will maybe happen when I go back. And this probably went on for, I don't know, 5-10 minutes with no mindfulness. It's very human, you know. It was not known mindfully. It was known obsessively, identified, fused with the story. Probably thought I was having the conversation at home, like, why did you do this, you know? And at some point, you know, the bell rang, somebody coughed, you know, something, and then there was a waking up, you know? So that's what happened eventually. Eventually, somebody coughed in the room, you know? And I got angry at them because, you know, I couldn't stay with my thoughts. They broke my meditation. I forgot what I was obsessing about. And then I remembered, oh, a retreat, mindfulness. What happened? Then I felt the body. Then I felt, you know, the contraction in the heart beating, the, I don't know, acidity, the discomfort in the body related to the thought. And then maybe there was some compassion. And then I just went back to the obsession. So I'm saying this in the hope that maybe we'll remember this when we're in the food line or having the tea. Oh, what's happening? What is happening? How is it met? Or the question can become, how could it be met? How could it be met? Recognition that there's a potential for mindfulness here, that it could be met with care, with curiosity, with calm maybe. And what happens when suddenly something is known with curiosity, with care, with awareness? What happens to it? Does it stay the same? Does it amplify? Does it morph into something? That's interesting. What happens with slight impatience when suddenly there's awareness that meets it? There's the birth, the beginning of impatience, and mindfulness comes in. What happens? Does it feed the impatience? Or is there maybe a kind of a choice that open to let it go, at least for a second? I wanted to talk about the three questions, and thinking about this third question of what happened after, as the kind of the message, one of the important message. I thought, oh yeah, I could spend a little time this afternoon talking about the messenger, the message. So I'm thinking, it's very rare that I do it, but somehow it happens. I'm thinking of the people who might listen to this later, and they might be like, what, the guard, the queen, the, you know. Go back to the other recording. No, but I can take a moment to just review that. So this image that is used in the texts of the city with the wall, the ancient walled city, and in the middle of this that ancient city, the queen sitting on a throne, and at the only gate, the only door of the walled city, there's a guard, and the job of the guard is to, if a messenger comes by, to recognize the messenger and bring the messenger straight to the queen. There's a street, an avenue, going straight from the entrance of the city to the heart of the city, the queen. The queen is consciousness, the guard is mindfulness, And the messenger is a phenomena. That's a kind of a code word in the Buddhist psychology, maybe. So what is a phenomena? Is it event? Is it presently arisen? Is it a now experience, a now event, something happening now? It could be a phenomena, could be a phenomenon, could be happening at any sense door, if I present it like this. It could be something that is heard, tasted, smelled, felt in the body, or it could come through the heart-mind door. It could be an emotion, a mood, it could be a thought, it could be a thought that we call sometimes memory. It could be so something like this. It's an event that happened at one of the six sense doors. That's one way to talk about the entirety of our life. Something happening at one of the sense doors. This is it. This is what we get so worked up about. Something, contact happening at the sense door. So basically a messenger, that's amazing. It could be anything. Anything has a message for consciousness to bring, to a message for wisdom. And often the messenger never gets to the queen, to the consciousness, because, you know, an event happened, a phenomenon happens, and we start building around it, embellishing, constructing, telling stories about, preferring, positioning ourselves. I don't want, I want, why is that happening, etc. And the message in it is lost. And it's an interesting way to talk about practice. No, I like. And so here what we do in practice is we pay attention in a very particular way to phenomena. We remove the glasses of what I want and don't want and what I prefer and etc. And we come close to the event, to the phenomenon itself, to kind of retrieve the message that is inside, the very precious message in it. Messages, I think there's a few messages, and that's what I'd like to talk about just now. So one message, you know, it's the message of impermanence. Do you agree that it can be easily missed, that message? You know, somebody says something, I'm like, you said that, I'm never going to forgive you, I'm going to make it solid, this is you now, you're the person who said that in 79, and that's it. You know, tack, you know. Ephemerality, impermanence, I don't care. I don't want that message. We've taken a ride, we've gone in the little streets of the city, and I'm going to make sure this message never gets to the queen. Yeah. And so what we're doing is a training in perception, is a perceptual training, is a training in cognition. That's what we're doing here this week. It's an amazing way to be. It's very different than, you know, when we're home, maybe the way I go about things is getting things done. I have a list that I'm plowing through, you know, and this is how I'm looking at life. This is done, this is not done yet, this will hopefully done soon, this tomorrow, you know, etc. And here it's a different thing we're doing, is we're coming close to events, experience, in order to retrieve the message, to perceive the message that is hidden in the phenomenon. Yeah. And so it's a very particular way to pay attention. It's not so much, for example, the content of the thought. What? You think? What are you saying? That I could relate to a thought without being completely obsessed by the content? No, of course, the only thing to do with the thought is to be fascinated by the content. Well, there's another way. You know, if you want to bring the message of the thought to the queen, you could notice that it arises and pass. Oh my God, that's the only thing you would do with a thought? I'm so invested in the content. And you're saying to just notice that it comes and goes. That could be helpful along the way, you know. You know, when I said this thing about the lump of earth, that I'm not going to explain. You just had to be there. Just flashed in my mind, you know, on the, sometimes these long retreats, Joseph Goldstein, I think, yeah, Joseph would say, you know, like, so at the beginning of, when it's a longer retreat, weeks, you know, there's a lot of instructions in the morning, in the talk, but at some point, it seems like you've covered a lot of ground, you know, after a few months, and it gets much more quiet. So there's not so much information in this way. There's plenty of information we've received that we can work with. But I think sometimes, you know, you would hear the click of the microphone coming on, you're like, oh, you know, after a couple of days of silence, or two or three days of nothing, you know. And I think Joseph would say something like, I wonder if the next thought is going to do it. And you know, you've been sitting there for months having thoughts, you know, and you're still none the wiser, in a way. And then you hear this, like, I wonder, and just it highlights the fascination for thoughts, like the way that I'm ready for the next thought. Like, I want the content of the next thought, as if it was going to bring a lot. And after having sat for a lot, you know, like, you, there's a few loops, you know. Oh, that tape number one, tape number two, I'm horrible. Tape number three, I'm great. Tape number, you know. And so in this perceptual training, as we slow down in the silence, as we pay attention, as we walk, as we stand, as we sit, as we breathe, as we eat, what we are training ourselves is to notice the appearing nature of things and their disappearing nature. You know, the sun comes out, goes down, cloud, a thought crosses the mind, irritation comes up, hope that I'm going to get, you know, something, and then, whoops, it vanishes, and then something else happens. So this is one of the important message. It can look like nothing. You're like, okay, yeah, impermanence. I've read a couple of Dharma books, you know, I know they keep coming back with this word. So I got it. But it's, you know, it's, what does it is a quality, sustained encounter or awareness of change, tracking change. So the mind that trains itself to notice, keep noticing. There's something about it, you know, that it's very, very, an image that is used in the text is, imagine you go to Canadian Tire. Yeah, I know. I was surprised too to find this in a sutta. And you get the hammer and... I mean, not me. If I get a hammer, 10 years later, it's probably going to look the same. But somebody who uses a hammer every day, you know, at some point, it's imperceptible, but at some point, the handle, you know, changes. You know, it gets used, you know. And it's the same thing. Like, it's our attention rubbing against change, noticing change. And that's how wisdom is developed. Like the more we notice, instead of training the mind to spot what I like, what I don't like, what should be happening, what shouldn't be happening, we train the mind to notice the fluctuation, the dynamic nature, the appearing, disappearing nature. When we, this, it has an incredible way to bring wisdom, for the mind to release this grasp on things, this way of solidifying, like, I don't like this. This actually arises and it will pass. You know, that's going to change the rapport, the relationship that we know this deeply. And information that I'm giving now, unfortunately, is not enough. It doesn't do it. It's really a high quality, sustained encounter with change that can do something at the level of understanding, perception. Yeah. This is one message. Another message that is hidden in phenomena is the message that it's defective. Phenomena are defective in terms of a human being that responds well to everything going the way they want. You know, if you're a human being that responds really well to things that are comfortable, secure, going your way, which, you know, it tends to be many of us, you know. Phenomena are not built like this. They don't do this. They don't go according to our wishes. They don't respond. It's not a law for them. It's not the law of nature. It's not. They don't recognize that. Phenomena don't behave in this way. And so from the point of view of a human being, maybe from another point of view, everything's perfect. But from the point of view of a sensitive human being, sensitive to what is pleasant, what is unpleasant, sensitive in all these ways, phenomena is very defective. Because it breaks. It appears when we don't want it. It disappears when we want it to stay. Do you recognize some of this? And even if it stays while we want it to stay, it could break. And just the knowledge that it could break is enough to bring stress. You know, it's going well right now, but will it continue at work, in my finances, with my family, with the world? You know, it's, you know, even if it's going well, just the fact that it could not is enough to bring a doo-doo, doo-doo, doo-doo. And so we train ourselves to notice impermanence. The impermanence is a great entry point to notice the defectiveness, the unstable nature, unreliable nature of things. Yeah. Even the, you might think like, but there's somebody in my life that I can really rely on. They're reliable. Don't do this. Don't make a phenomena out of this person, please, Pascal. They're really reliable. They are and they're not. They are in their personality or values or the, you know, they are, but they are liable to, you know, knocking their head and or hurting themselves in a way that they won't be able to show up. You know, they're defective, and it's not a judgment on things. It's a recognition of the uncertain nature of things. You know, that things can come together, but could also not come together or change. And this knowledge, I think we already have to some extent. That's why we're here. Because we've seen, you know, that it hasn't worked perfectly. Like, we might have put our eggs in that basket, you know. I don't know what it is. Social status, family, blah, blah, blah. And then we're saying, but it doesn't totally do it. It's a little bit more unstable than that, than what I thought or hoped for. If it had worked, we wouldn't be here. And it doesn't mean that it worked for others. Like, oh, there's plenty of people who are not here. It means it worked for them. No, it sucks for them too. Even the richest, which is surprising. That's why maybe we can be fascinated. Look at, wow, they look miserable. How can they? You know? Because things are defective outside, but also inside. You know, you can't totally rely on this body. It subject to old age, disease, can't rely on this mind. I can rely on my mind. I've been independent my whole life, yes, but, you know, a couple of nights without sleeps and the intelligence shows that it's shaky, you know. Or diagnosis, drugs, whoops, suddenly, I don't know, the quickness, the humor, the clarity, gone, you know. And so this is, I'm talking about this kind of lightly, this is poignant stuff, this is important stuff, we're talking about the nature of reality here. Phenomena are by nature unstable, changing, uncertain. And here, instead of denying this, hoping for something else, we turn towards reality. It's not easy to do. It takes a lot of courage to do this, to say, like, actually, let me look at things factually. Because there's potential there. I might find ways to meet that. Discover amazing qualities to, you know, what do you do when you're in a world that is uncertain, defective? So that's the relationship. How are we going to relate to this, to a world like this? On the path, we'll discover for ourselves, we'll discover maybe we're practicing in community, listening to the teachings. We'll discover for ourselves that compassion is a very beautiful way, appropriate, wise way to be in relationship with an uncertain world. Compassion, creativity, integrity, care, ethics, joy. When something comes together, it's very appropriate to rejoice that it came to be, that there was this encounter, this being, this moment, wow, the appreciation is a really wise response to when things come together in a beautiful way, when there is success, or when there is clarity or ease, or to rejoice for self, rejoice for others. So the information in what's happening, the way we relate to what's happening, will help us retrieve the information in it. And what we'll discover seems like bad news, but it's not something we're adding. You know, it's not like we're making the world defective and uncertain. It already was. We're just starting to notice and discover how are we going to relate to this now. There's another information hidden in phenomena. Is that, or maybe it's enough? Or maybe you're like, no, that's enough. It's changing, it's ephemeral, it's defective. I think that's enough information for today, Pascal. Keep some for tomorrow. Keep some good surprise for tomorrow. I could. Is that what you want?
No.
I'll take a little drink. Make it a double. So there's another information that is really interesting, that is hidden. I mean, that's counterintuitive. Maybe we'll think, yeah, this is really well hidden. I can't actually see it. I've already named it, so it's not going to be a big surprise. But I'm bringing it back for our consideration. And so what information is hidden in phenomena that can be revealed in the way that we'll be relating to it. Do you see like how I'm playing with these three questions still? You know, so there's something happening, a phenomena. How is it known? If it's known carefully, with mindfulness, we might be able to get the information out of the impermanent nature, of the fact that it can't provide complete satisfaction. You know, sometimes we have that kind of illusion, you know, the bell ringing, we know it's the meal, you know. So if we stay attentive, we'll notice beautiful taste appear and disappear. And at the end, well, it's not going to have solved everything, you know, like I'm still going to be stuck on retreat. It did give reprieve, is that the word? But it didn't solve everything. Although I might have unconsciously, for a few minutes, invested a lot in the meal. You know, can't wait for the meal, can't wait for the meal. You know, and then after, you're like, oh, oh yeah. Oh, it didn't quite do it. Now I feel full. It's like there's, it's defective, you know. Because it was so good that now I feel like bloated. And, you know, okay. So it was just not just enjoyment, there's a cost. Maybe, or something, or it's more complex, you know, in some ways. Another information, yes, yes. I have 7 minutes. So the other information that is hidden, maybe in the phenomena, is the fact that it can't be owned. Although it might, with superficial attention, look like mine, if I pay close attention to the phenomena, I might discover that although it looked or felt or had a strong sense or impression that it was me or mine, that it's not, it cannot be. And so, in a way, what we're talking about here is some kind of maturity. We're maturing enough to be able to maybe consider this. And I was talking about this last month in Vancouver, and somebody told me about he said, thank you so much, I thought it was really good. He told me about the property laws, the toddler's property laws. Have you heard this? So, law number one, if I like it, it's mine. If it's in my hand, it's mine. If I can take it from you, it's mine. If I had it a little while ago, it's mine. If it's mine, it must never appear to be yours in any way. If I'm doing or building something, all of the pieces are mine. If it looks like mine, it's mine. If I saw it first, it's mine. If you are playing with something and you put it down, it automatically becomes mine. If it's broken, it's yours. And at some point in that story, we go on a retreat. And we discover that maybe these laws are mistaken view. Maybe it's a little different, maybe very different than that. And so we start paying attention. It looks like nothing as we're just sitting here, breathing, as we're stepping, smelling, tasting, as thoughts come by, moods swing by, and we start to discover that, this is not exactly me, this is not exactly mine. The breath is gone. This in-breath is gone. Why am I still here? And that's gone if it was me, you know? I'm playing kind of intellectually with this, but for us it's different. It's empirically. It's by contact we discover that the step is something that happened. There was this, I don't know, movement, hardness, softness appeared and disappeared. This can't be owned by anybody. It's just living matter, play of four elements, if we put it in that language. It was not mine. And maybe we'll discover the same thing, that a thought is not exactly me or mine. It appears uninvited, maybe learned through culture or something else. You know? Even emotions, that suddenly there is an emotion, but maybe it's not exactly me, mine, but it's visiting, it's in the field, you know, it's there, it's doing what it does, but it came through conditions, right conditions, you know. Earlier I was outside and we had just talked in one group about mindfulness of mind state, in movement, that maybe there was more of a challenge to recognize the mind state as we were moving about than when being still. And we were reflecting, considering this. And just after I went to practice outside, and I was walking, and I was like, it's true, I can't know, I don't know how I feel. It's either neutral, I can't tell. And then the bird sang, and then there was joy. And while I was walking, it was very clear there was joy. I could recognize joy. And, you know, it was also clear that it was conditional. The joy was because of the bird song. So was it mine or was it the bird's? It was neither. I mean, it clearly was not the bird, but I didn't say, okay, I'm going to be joyful. Like, it's not mine this way. It happened. I was more the victim of joy. You know, in a way, it arose, and it was conditional to a bird song. Without the bird song, not the joy. This was the bird song joy. It was related, highly related, completely related, to not separate from the bird song. And so as we pay attention, we're probably going to discover in phenomena that just by the mere fact that they're impermanent, that they can't actually be owned. And also, we'll discover another angle of this, is that because they're conditional, things are conditional, they need condition, then it makes them not exactly mine, because they belong more to conditionality, to conditions. You know, so, and this is, I'm naming it last because it's the most counterintuitive, the most, maybe it might feel threatening as you hear this, like, what are you saying? I'm not in there, there's not my, nothing is mine. What, you know, like it might, it's kind of poking at our worldview, you know, our way of understanding the world, and might trigger some kind of like, don't touch that, you know, don't touch my, what belongs to me. You know? But we're invited to pay attention to see what's the information hidden, and what message is the messenger carrying, and how can the guard, mindfulness, bring that message to the queen. The result of these messages brought to the queen is what we, you know, wisdom, liberation, freedom. That's what happens when the message gets through, is that something opens in the heart. You know. Okay, could that be that? Could that be it for now? Okay. Thank you so much for your consideration. Let's just take a moment to check in. What's happening? How is it known? How could it be known? And this is what happened after. Thank you very much for listening. Thank you. And bon appétit.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.